Today is Thursday, June 10th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden set for high-level talks with leaders from major democracies in UK.
He believes democracies can still get together to reach a consensus to respond to autocrats.
Plus, UN commends Indonesian government for offering haven to Rohingya refugees.
9 refugees reportedly had died by the time their harrowing 4-month odyssey came to an end last Friday.
Also, a report on how a 24,000-year-old microscopic organism came back to life. Our top story today is in the U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden landed in Europe Wednesday. It's his first overseas trip as the chief executive. Biden is set to hold high-level talks with other Western heads of state before meeting next week with Russian President Vladimir Putin at a summit in Geneva. International Edition's host Steve Miller spoke with VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman to get an idea of what a successful trip looks like for the president.
President Biden himself has been talking about what he hopes to accomplish on this trip when he boarded Air Force One to Andrews Air Force Base before flying across the Atlantic. He said that one of the top priorities for him by attending the G7 summit and also attending a NATO meeting in Brussels is strengthening the alliances of the United States. At the G7 on Thursday, he is expected to announce a vaccine plan for the world as the entire planet tries to recover from this global pandemic. And this is top priority, and it's expected to be very well received by the G7 countries and other nations as well that have been really clamoring for the United States to do more.
Another meeting that's getting a lot of attention this trip, Steve, is Biden's upcoming meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman responded to a VOA question during a question and answer video session at the German Marshall Fund of the United States of America on the issue of Russian crackdowns on critics.
We've also been very clear that when Russia abuses the rights of its people, as they have done repeatedly regarding Navalny, that we will speak up, that we will push back, that we will raise our concerns. We will try to bring the international community with us in that concern and to try to ensure that Mr. Navalny is safe.
Steve, what expectations have been set by the White House for this meeting?
Well, again, we've been hearing from President Biden at the start of this trip about that Putin meeting. The president's first stop after flying across the Atlantic was an address to U.S. troops and family members stationed at Royal Air Force Mildenhall. That's home to the U.S. Air Force's 100th Air Refueling Wing. And President Biden said, "I will tell Putin what I will tell him." That was sort of a vague comment, but it got cheers from the crowd. And then Biden said, "I'm going to communicate that there are consequences for violating the sovereignty of democracies in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere." He went on to underscore his belief that world democracies will not only endure but thrive, and in a message which could be seen as a preface to his meeting with Putin and also a signal to Beijing, Biden said we have to discredit those who believe that the age of democracy is over. And he explained that though things are changing rapidly, he believes democracies can still get together to reach a consensus to respond to autocrats.
That's Steve Herman, VOA's White House Bureau Chief, speaking with my colleague Steve Miller. U.S. President Joe Biden on Wednesday said the United States was not seeking conflict with Russia, but would respond in a, quote, robust and meaningful way, unquote, to the Russian government engage in harmful activities. Biden speaking at the start of an 8-day visit to Europe that would include a NATO summit and a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, said he would underscore Washington's, quote, rock-solid, unquote, commitment to the transatlantic alliance.
We're not seeking conflict with Russia. We want a stable, predictable relationship. Our two nations share incredible responsibilities, and among them, ensuring strategic stability and upholding arms control agreements. I take that responsibility seriously. But I've been clear. The United States will respond in a robust and meaningful way when the Russian government engages in harmful activities.
That's U.S. President Joe Biden. Some 200 bodies have been buried in shallow graves in and around the town of Hausin, Ethiopia, after more than 7 months of war in the Tigray region. As VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Hausin, residents fear the fighting will continue and more people will be killed.
Some mass graves in the Ethiopian town of Hausin hold dozens of bodies. Some hold only a few. Locals say there are about 20 graves in all, containing bodies that were found in the streets of the town after multiple battles. The most recent happened just a few weeks ago.
The bodies lay out on the ground for 7 or 8 days, and there's no one to help us take them to the church. So a few of us buried them. They smelled bad, rotting, and attracting maggots.
Most Hausin residents have fled their homes, many to live in crowded camps without enough food. The town itself is in ruins. The families who remain say there is almost no way to make a living. Hausin has changed hands about 5 times since the war began in November between the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front and Ethiopian and Eritrean forces. Ethiopian troops now control most of the region, including Hausin. But fighting continues, and residents fear war could break out at any moment. In the market, few sellers make any money these days, the woman adds, but they sit there all day, hoping for luck. On the outskirts of Hausin, Lete Gourmet says she doesn't expect much luck in this beleaguered town, as residents continue to bury civilians killed in war. She says among the dead are children and the elderly.
The killing continues. Recently, we buried another 7 bodies near the church.
This war has claimed thousands of lives and left millions of people displaced. Here in Hausin, some say they are no longer afraid because they cannot imagine anything worse could happen. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Hausin, Ethiopia.
On Thursday, the World Food Program said new data shows at least 350,000 people in Tigray face famine and about 4 million are struggling with severe hunger. The WFP says its emergency program in the region has 180 staff and reaches 1.4 million people, but says that is barely half the number who need immediate help. Pressure is growing on Somalia's government after a report this week that thousands of Somali troops sent for training in Eritrea ended up fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray conflict. Parents of missing troops have blamed President Mohamed Abdallah Mohamed, known as Farmajo, who denies the reports. But as Mohamed Kahiye reports from Mogadishu, a parliamentary committee is demanding an investigation into the troops' whereabouts.
A report by UN Human Rights Council released this week says troops from Somalia who were trained in Eritrea have taken part in the fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Somalia's government has consistently denied that its troops were present in Tigray. Forced Wardera is among hundreds of parents seeking answers from the Somali government. Her son, 22-year-old Sid Ali Abdi, was among the troops sent to Eritrea for training. She says her son left for Eritrea in February last year, and she didn't hear from him until January this year. She added that he called again last week, but she is afraid for his life and therefore is calling upon authorities to ensure his safe return home. Somalia's President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo has not commented on the soldiers, despite demands from their parents and the opposition leaders. Parliament's Foreign Affairs and International Relations Committee has sent 2 letters to the Office of the President for clarification on the matter, but has gotten no response. Mohamed Hassan Idris, who is a member of the powerful committee, said the president must take responsibility for the national security matter.
We have raised our concerns and demanded the president to come out clean on the allegation that Somali soldiers training in Eritrea were deployed in Ethiopia and Tigray. Despite our two official letters and verbal demands, including the daily protest by the parents of the soldiers, unfortunately, the president has never come out to respond to the disappearance of these children. But instead, he kept silence, and it is very, very disturbing situation.
In June 2018, the leaders of Somalia, Ethiopia and Eritrea signed a security, political and economic cooperation agreement.
That's Mohamed Kahihi reporting from Mogadishu. Anti-corruption and environmental rights group Global Witness is seeking an appeal against the dismissal of a graft case against oil giants Shell and Eni over their controversial acquisition of an oil field in Nigeria. Judges in the Italian city of Milan acquitted the defendants in March over ownership of OPL245 oil fields in the West African nation. For more, I spoke with Barnaby Pace, senior campaigner for Global Witness, on why the group disagrees with the judgment.
We're somewhat mystified by elements of this ruling. The judges appear to have applied a very high standard to require any conviction for corruption in this case, requiring not just evidence of illicit payments and potentially illicit act by a public official, but proof of an explicit express agreement. That's something incredibly hard to come by in corruption cases. And even in this case where the judges said, you know, the $500 million that went into cash in Nigeria untraceably is very suspicious, they were unable to find sufficient proof to convict anyone. That's a very high bar in it. Promises to potentially give a get-out-of-jail-free card in corruption cases in the future.
What would you say to those who say, this case is in Nigeria, this case is about Nigeria? What do you have at stake in this matter?
We care about anti-corruption more generally, but Italy is involved in this because it involves one of Italy's biggest companies, Eni. Two of the world's biggest fossil fuel companies, Shell and Eni, both did this deal for over $1 billion, sending money all over the world as a result. Corruption and corruption allegations like those in this case don't just affect Nigerians. Obviously, they do very severely, and I think everyone in Nigeria would speak to the importance of tackling the issue of corruption. But it's not just a Nigerian problem. This is a global problem.
Do you have the support of the Nigerian government on this matter, or are you just going it alone?
This, I should stress, is not our case. This is a case brought by the Italian public prosecutor in Milan. But yes, the Nigerian state, the Federal Republic of Nigeria, acted as a civil party in the case and said that they are a victim of a crime in this case, asking for compensation. They've also taken separate civil proceedings against a bank that was involved in this deal, JP Morgan in the UK. And Nigerian anti-corruption agencies are currently pursuing corruption prosecutions, criminal trials against various former officials and indeed also Shell and Eni subsidiaries in Nigeria. I should say all those former officials and indeed the companies have pleaded not guilty in the cases.
That's Barnaby Pace, senior campaigner for Global Witness, speaking with me from the UK. UN agencies have commended the Indonesian government for offering a haven to dozens of Rohingya refugees who have been stranded at sea for months. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
90 Rohingya embarked on their ill-fated journey from Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, in the first week of February. 9 refugees reportedly had died by the time their harrowing 4-month odyssey came to an end last Friday. Spokesman for the UN Migration Agency, Paul Dillon, says the boat ran into trouble almost immediately after it set sail. He says the engine broke down, leaving the group adrift at sea and putting the refugees' lives at risk.
They ran into engine trouble again near East Aceh last week. A local fisherman discovered their stranded vessel and brought them to safety. Upon disembarkation, local government of Aceh officials immediately conducted rapid COVID-19 tests, and COVID-19 vaccinations were subsequently provided to all of the arrivals.
Dillon says his agency is providing food, drinking water, and medical support to the 81 Rohingya who survived the journey. He says the group consists of 45 women, 17 men, and 19 children. UN refugee spokesman Baba Baloch says the UNHCR and humanitarian partners also are on site to provide additional support and to ensure that refugee needs are met. He notes this is not the first time Rohingya refugees at sea have been rescued by the communities and local authorities in Aceh, Indonesia. He praises them for providing a lifeline to the desperate people, noting not all nations are as humane.
It is both a humanitarian imperative and international obligation to provide vessels in distress with life-saving assistance and disembarkation to a place of safety. Vulnerable women, children, and men should not be left to the mercy of the high seas.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya fled to Bangladesh to escape violence and persecution in Myanmar in 2017. Human rights officials say thousands of refugees flee the overcrowded camps in Cox's Bazar every year in hopes of achieving a better life in countries such as Malaysia and Thailand. The International Organization for Migration says roughly 1,400 Rohingya found themselves stranded at sea during the 2020 sailing season, which ended with the arrival of the monsoons in early June. It says at least 130 Rohingya are reported to have died. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. Pope Francis has refused to accept the resignation of German Cardinal Reinhard Marx over the sex abuse scandal in the church. In a letter, Francis said a reform process was necessary and that every bishop must take responsibility for the crisis. Francis wrote a letter in response to Marx's unexpected announcement last week that he had offered to resign as Archbishop of Munich and Freising over the church's mishandling of abuse cases. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The U.S. is set to buy 500 million more doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to share globally. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
According to people familiar with the plan, President Biden tomorrow will announce the administration's going to buy 500 million doses for sharing through the global COVAX alliance.
To help donate more doses to poor countries around the world.
White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan would not confirm the plan while flying to Europe with the president. Sources say 200 million doses would be shared this year and the rest in the first half of next year. The announcement comes days after the White House unveiled plans to start sharing America's existing vaccine surplus with other nations. Sagar Magani, Washington.
By any measure, the number of those being vaccinated against COVID-19 in Africa is running behind the rest of the world. Health experts warn that failure to vaccinate the 1.3 billion people on the continent will have a huge impact on its healthcare systems and economies. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
More than a year into the COVID-19 pandemic, most African countries have vaccinated only a tiny fraction of their citizens. Nigeria, the most populous nation in Africa, has fully vaccinated just 0.1% of the population. The Africa Center for Disease Control says three countries, Tanzania, Burundi, Eritrea, and the self-declared Sahrawi Republic, have yet to receive any vaccines, while Burkina Faso has received 115,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine, but has yet to give a single jab to its citizens. Abdallah Ziraba is an epidemiologist and the head of the health system at the African Population and Health Research Center in Nairobi. He says the failure to vaccinate is partly due to vaccine hesitancy among the population and underdeveloped healthcare systems, especially in non-urban areas.
The other important reason why there's been inequity is the weak healthcare system. In Africa, most people live in rural areas, and the healthcare system, which should be the system to deliver the vaccines to the last person, is not as elaborate as the population is distributed. So some people are very far away from where they can get access to vaccines, and as a consequence, they are definitely left out, but they remain at risk of getting exposed to COVID-19.
Kenya has fully vaccinated just 13,000 people out of a population of 50 million, although about 1 million have received one dose of a vaccine. Devji Atela is the Secretary General of the Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union. He calls for the government to allocate 1% of the country's budget to purchase COVID-19 vaccines.
Countries like, let's say, Uganda or here in Kenya and these others, we can still see the waves, the surge in the infection. So the ultimate way to have things back to normal is to vaccinate. And that's why we are asking the government that in the budget, current budget is about 3.6 trillion. If 1% of it, that's about 35 billion, is put into buying of the vaccine for the Kenyans, then we may have hope to see the opening up.
Kenya's western region is witnessing high coronavirus infections in recent weeks, and officials have warned they may have to impose a new lockdown to stop transmission. In neighboring Uganda, the government recently reintroduced a strict lockdown to fight an increase in infections. The lockdown includes shutting down the schools and religious activities and imposing travel bans within the country. Zaraba says African countries' failure to vaccinate their population will disrupt everyday life and will be a problem to the rest of the world.
It will be a cascade that will be very disruptive of the African countries' economies and healthcare system. But the rest of the world will not sit pretty, because while a big part of their population will be protected, they will not be comfortable knowing that there will be new infections coming to their borders every now and then.
Overall, Africa has recorded about 5 million cases of COVID-19 and 133,000 deaths. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
For more than a year, Haiti escaped the worst ravages of the COVID-19 pandemic, reporting few cases and fatalities, a rare break for the poorest country in the Americas, which has so often been beset by misfortune. Gavin Ogare of Reuters reports.
As some countries are already moving into a post-pandemic world thanks to vaccination campaigns, Haiti is grappling with its first serious outbreak, and the country has yet to receive its first batch of vaccine doses or administer a single shot. Doctors like Ronald Laroche are also sounding the alarm.
Toutes les structures de soins, publics comme privés, sont dépassées.
All public and private sites are taking in patients. There's no room for any more. More sites must be opened to meet the needs of patients with breathing difficulties so as to avert a catastrophe.
Officially, Haiti has recorded nearly 16,000 infections and 333 deaths from COVID-19 among its 11 million people, relatively low case numbers compared to elsewhere in Latin America and the Caribbean. Yet data is limited due to low testing rates, and doctors say the real numbers are likely much higher. And local health officials are warning the upwards trend could prove catastrophic. President Jovenel Moïse, who at one point urged Haitians to drink unproven medicinal tea to ward off the virus, is now implementing strict public health measures.
We are taking measures to prohibit ceremonies, recreational activities, end of school year celebrations. Those activities are to be prohibited. These are measures taken by the government to protect students and educational personnel during this difficult moment where the coronavirus is causing real victims.
Poor sanitation means disease can spread fast in Haiti. Its slums are densely packed, and its already overwhelmed and inefficient healthcare system is dependent on fecal donations in the race against the virus.
That's Gavin Ogare of Reuters. A microscopic organism came back to life and reproduced asexually after lying frozen in the vast permafrost lands of northeastern Siberia for 24,000 years. Russian scientists found a tiny ancient animal called the Deloid rotifer in soil taken from the river Azia in Russia's region of Yakutia in the far north. The Deloid rotifer, a multicellular organism found in freshwater habitats across the world, is known to be able to withstand extreme cold. Previous research suggested it could survive for a decade when frozen at minus 20 degrees Celsius. This new case, which was detailed in a study in the journal Current Biology, is by far the creature's longest recorded survival period in a frozen state. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.